standing. I take a step into the street away from him. I feel myself begin to tremble, just as he steps into the street and closes the gap between us. His eyes are on the house across the street again, as he reaches his arm around me, pressing a firm hand into my lower back. He begins pushing me along with him as he points toward the house opposite where my daughter lives.
Get inside before they see you.
I expected he'd eventually put the pieces together. I just wish he would have made the connection last night. Not right now, when I'm only 15 feet away from her. I look at his house, then look at Patrick and Grace's house. I have no method of escaping him. The last thing I want to do right now is cause a scene. My goal was to arrive peacefully and make this go as smoothly as possible. Ledger seems to want the opposite.
Please leave me alone,
I say through clenched teeth. This is none of your business.
The fuck it isn't,
he hisses.
Ledger, please.
My voice shakes from both fear and tears. I'm scared of him. Scared of this moment. Scared of the idea that this is going to be so much more difficult than I feared. Why else would he be pushing me away from their property? I look back at Patrick and Grace's house, but my feet keep moving toward Ledger's house. I would put up a fight, but at this point, I'm no longer sure I'm ready to face the Landrys. I thought I was ready when I got into the cab earlier. But now that I'm here and Ledger is mad, I'm absolutely not ready to face them. It's obvious from the last few minutes that my arrival might have been somewhat anticipated and is not at all welcomed. They were likely notified when I was released into transitional housing. They had to be expecting this to happen eventually. My feet are no longer weights. I feel like I'm floating again, high in the air like a balloon, and I'm following Ledger as if he's pulling me along by a string. I feel embarrassed to be here. Embarrassed enough to follow behind Ledger like I have no voice or thoughts of my own. I certainly don't have any confidence in this second. And my shirt is too stupid for a moment of this magnitude. I'm stupid for thinking this was the way to go about it. Ledger closes his door once we're inside his living room. He looks disgusted. I don't know if it's at the sight of me, or if he's thinking about last night. He's pacing the living room, one palm pressed against his forehead.
Is that why you showed up at my bar? Were you trying to trick me into leading you to her?
No!
My voice is pathetic. He slides his hands down his face in frustration. He pauses and then just mutters,
God damn it.
He is so mad at me. Why do I always make the worst decisions?
You've been in town for one day.
He swipes keys off a table.
You really thought this was a good idea, showing up this soon?
This soon? She's 4 years old. I clench an arm over my churning stomach. I don't know what to do. What do I do? What can I do? There has to be something, some kind of compromise. They can't just collectively decide what's best for DM without consulting me. Can they? They can. I'm the unreasonable one in this scenario. I've just been too scared to admit it. I want to ask him if there's anything I can do to get them to hear me out. But the way he's glaring at me makes me feel completely in the wrong. I begin to wonder if I'm even in a position to ask questions. His focus falls to the rubber starfish in my hand. He walks over to me and holds out his hand. I place the starfish in his palm. I don't know why I hand it over. Maybe if he sees I showed up with a toy, he'll know I'm here with good intentions.
Really? A teething ring?
He tosses it on his couch like it's the stupidest thing he's ever seen.
She's 4!
He walks toward his kitchen.
I'm taking you home. Wait until I pull my truck into the garage. I don't want them to see you.
I no longer feel like I'm floating. I feel heavy and frozen, like my feet are trapped in the concrete slab of his house. I glance out the living room window toward Patrick and Grace's house. I'm so close. All that separates us is a street,
an empty street with no traffic. It's clear to me what's going to happen next. Patrick and Grace want nothing to do with me, to the point Ledger knew to intercept my arrival. This means there won't be any negotiating. The forgiveness I was hoping had found its way to them never made it here. They still hate me. Apparently, so does everyone else in their lives. The only way I'm going to be able to see my daughter is if, by some miracle, I can take it through the court system. And that's going to take money I don't yet have, and years I can't bear the thought of passing by. I've already missed so much. If I want to see DM at all, ever, this is my only chance. If I want the opportunity to beg Scotty's parents for forgiveness, it's now or never. Now or never. Ledger probably won't notice I'm not following him to his garage for another 10 seconds at least. I might make it before he catches up to me. I slip outside and run as fast as I can across the street. I'm in their yard. My feet are sprinting across grass DM has played on. I'm beating on their front door. I'm ringing their doorbell. I'm trying to look through the window to get a glimpse of her. Please, I whisper, knocking harder. My whisper turns into panic as I hear Ledger approaching me from behind. I'm sorry, I yell, beating on the door. My voice is a fearful plea. I'm sorry, please let me see her. I'm being pulled and then carried back to the house across the street. Even through my struggle to get out of his arms, I'm staring at that front door as it gets smaller and smaller, hoping for even a half-second glimpse of my little girl. I don't see any movement at all in their house before I'm no longer outside. I'm back inside Ledger's house, being dropped onto his couch. He's holding his phone, pacing his living room as he dials a phone number. It's only 3 digits. He's calling the police. I panic. No! Plead. No, no, no! I lunge across his living room in an attempt to grab at his phone, but he just puts a hand on my shoulder and steers me back to the couch. I sit down and bury my elbows into my knees, bringing my fingers to a shaky point against my mouth. Please don't call the police. Please! I sit still, wanting to appear unthreatening, hoping he just looks me in the eye long enough to feel my pain. His eyes meet mine just as tears begin to fall down my cheeks. He pauses before completing the call. He stares me down, studying me, searching my face for a promise. I won't come back. If he calls the police, this will not look good for me. I can't have anything added to my record, even though I've broken no laws that I know of. But just being here unwanted is enough of a mark against me. He takes a step closer.
You cannot come back here. Swear to me we'll never see you again, or I'll call the police right now.
I can't promise him that. What else is there in my life other than my daughter? She's all I have. She's why I'm still alive. This can't be happening. Please. I cry, not knowing what I'm even begging for. I just want someone to listen to me, to hear me out, to understand how much I'm suffering. I want him to be the man I met in the bar last night. I want him to pull me to his chest, to make me feel like I have an ally. I want him to tell me it's going to be okay, even though I know with everything in me that it will never, ever be okay. The next several minutes are a defeated blur. I'm a mess of emotions. I get into Ledger's truck, and he drives me away from the neighborhood my daughter has been raised in her whole life. I'm finally in the same town as her after all these years, but I've never felt farther away from her than I do in this moment. I press my forehead to the passenger window, and I close my eyes, wishing I could start over from the beginning. The very beginning. Or at least fast forward to the end.
Chapter 12. Ledger. It's typical for people to be praised in death, heralded to the point of heroism sometimes. But nothing anyone said about Scotty was embellished for the sake of remembering him fondly. He was everything everyone said about him. Nice, funny, athletic, honest, charismatic, a good son, a great friend. Not a day goes by that I don't wish I could have traded places with him, in life and in death. I'd give up the life I've been living in an instant if it meant he could have just one day with Diem. I don't know that I'd be this angry, this protective over Diem, if Kenna had just simply caused the accident. But she did so much more than that. She was driving when she shouldn't have been. She was speeding. She was drinking. She flipped the car. And then she left. She left Scotty there to die. And she walked home and crawled into bed because she thought she could get away with it. He's dead because she was scared she'd get in trouble. And now she wants forgiveness? I can't think about the details of Scotty's death right now. Not with her sitting next to me in this truck, because I'd rather be dead than allow her the satisfaction of knowing Diem. If it means driving us both off a bridge, I might just be vengeful enough to do that right now. The fact that she thought it would be okay to show up is baffling to me. I'm pissed she's here, but I think my anger is amplified by the knowledge that she knew who I was last night, when we kissed, when I held her. I shouldn't have ignored my gut. There was something off about her. She doesn't look like the Kenna I saw in the articles 5 years ago. Scotty's Kenna had long blonde hair. But I never really looked at her face back then. I never met her in person. But I feel like even just seeing a mugshot of the girl who killed my best friend should have stuck in my head more. I feel stupid. I'm angry. I'm hurt. I feel taken advantage of. Even today in the store, she knew who I was, yet gave me no hint as to who she was. I crack my window to get some fresh air, hoping it'll calm me down. My knuckles are white as I grip the steering wheel. She's staring out the window, unresponsive. She may be crying. I don't know. I don't fucking care. I don't. She isn't the girl I met last night. That girl doesn't exist. She was pretending with me, and I fell right into her trap. Patrick expressed concern several months ago when we found out she was released. He thought this might happen, that she might show up wanting to meet Diem. I even put in a Ring camera on my house that points at their front yard. It's how I knew someone was sitting on the curb. I told Patrick he was silly to worry. She wouldn't show up, not after what she did. I gripped the steering wheel even tighter. Kenna might have brought Diem into the world, but that's where her claim to Diem ends. When her apartments come into view, I pull the truck into a spot and put it in park. I don't kill the engine, but Kenna doesn't make a move to exit my truck. I figured she'd jump out before I even came to a complete stop like she did last night, but it looks like there's something she wants to say. Or maybe she just dreads going into that apartment as much as she probably dreads staying in this truck. She's staring at her hands folded together in her lap. She brings her hand to the seatbelt and releases it, but when she's free from it, she remains in the same position. Diem looks like her. I always assumed she did since I didn't see much of Scotty in Diem's features. But until tonight, I had no idea just how much she resembles her mother. They have the same reddish shade of brown hair, straight and flat, not a wave or a curl in sight. She has Kenna's eyes. Maybe that's why I saw red flags last night. My subconscious recognized her before I could. When Kenna's eyes slide over to mine, I feel a tug of disappointment inside of me. DM looks so much like her when she's sad. It's like I'm looking into the future at who DM is going to someday be. I don't like that the one person I dislike the most in this world reminds me of the person I love the most. Kenna wipes her eyes, but I don't lean over and open the glove box to retrieve a napkin. She can use the Mountain Dew shirt she's been wearing for 2 days.
I didn't know you before I showed up at your bar last night,
she says with a trembling voice.
I swear.
Her head falls back against the headrest, and she stares straight ahead. Her chest rises with a deep inhale. She exhales at the exact moment my finger meets the unlock button, my cue for her to exit. I don't care about last night. I care about Diem. That's it. I watch a tear as it skates down her jaw. I hate that I know what those tears taste like. I hate that part of me wants to reach over and wipe it away. I wonder if she cried as she was walking away from Scotty that night. She moves with a graceful sadness, leaning forward, pressing her face into her hands. Her movement fills my truck with the scent of her shampoo. It smells like fruit. Apples. I rest my elbow on my doorframe and lean away from her, covering my mouth and nose with my hand. I look out my window, not wanting to know anything else about her. I don't want to know what she smells like, what she sounds like, what her tears look like, what her pain makes me feel like. They don't want you in her life, Kenna. A cry mixes with a gasp that sounds like it's filled with years of heartache when she says,
She's my daughter.
Her voice decides to reconnect with her spirit in this moment. It's no longer a wisp of air escaping her mouth. It's full of panic and desperation. I grip my steering wheel, tapping it with my thumb while I think of how to say what I need for her to understand. Diem is their daughter. Your rights were terminated. Get out of my truck, and then do us all a favor and go back to Denver. I don't know if the sob that escapes her is even real. She wipes her cheeks and then opens the door and steps out of my truck. She faces me before closing the door, and she looks so much like Diem. Even her eyes have grown a shade lighter like Diem's do when she cries. I feel that look deep within me. But I know it's only because of how closely she resembles Diem. I'm hurting for Diem, not for this woman. Kenna looks torn between walking away, responding to me, or screaming. She hugs herself and looks at me with two huge, devastated eyes. She tilts her face up toward the sky for a second, inhaling a shaky breath.
Fuck you, Ledger.
The sting of agony in her voice makes me flinch internally, but I remain as stoic as possible on the outside. Her words weren't even a yell. They were just a quiet and piercing statement. She slams my truck door, then slaps my window with both of her palms.
Fuck you!
I don't wait for her to say it a third time. I throw the truck in reverse and pull back onto the street. My stomach is in a knot that feels tethered to her fist. The farther I get from her, the more I feel it unravel. I don't know what I expected. I've had this vision of her in my head all these years, a girl with no remorse for what she's done, a mother with no attachment to the child she brought into the world. 5 years of preconceived yet solid notions aren't easy to let go of. Kenna has been one way and one way only in my mind. Unremorseful, uninvolved, uncaring, unworthy. I can't reconcile the emotional turmoil she seems to suffer from not being part of Diem's life with the lack of regard she held for Scotty's life. I drive away while thinking of a million things I should have said, a million questions I still don't have answers to. Why didn't you call for help? Why did you leave him there? Why do you think you deserve to cause another upheaval in the lives you've already destroyed? Why do I still want to hug you?
Chapter 13. Kenna. I feel like I'm living my worst-case scenario. Not only did I not get to meet my daughter today, but the only person who might have been able to lead me to her is now enemy number one. I hate him. I hate that I let him touch me last night. I hate that in the brief time I spent with him yesterday, I gave him all the ammunition to label me a liar, a whore, an alcoholic, as if murderer wasn't enough. He's going to go straight to Grace and Patrick and reinforce their hatred for me. He's going to help them build an even sturdier, taller, thicker wall between me and my daughter. I have no one on my side, not a single person. Hi. I pause halfway up the stairwell. There's a teenage girl sitting at the top of the stairs. She has Down syndrome and she's smiling at me adorably, like this isn't the worst day of my life. She's wearing the same type of work shirt that Amy had on at the grocery store. She must work there. Amy said they give grocery bagger positions to people with special needs. I wipe tears from my cheeks and mutter, "Hi," and then sidestep around her. I would normally make more of an effort to be neighborly, especially if I'm going to be working with this girl, but I have more tears in my throat than words. I open my apartment door, and once I'm inside, I slam it shut and fall face down onto my half-deflated mattress. I can't even say I'm back to square one. I feel like I'm at square negative one now. My door swings open and I immediately sit up. The girl from the stairs walks into my apartment uninvited. "Why are you crying?" She closes the door behind her and leans against it, scanning my apartment with curious eyes. "Why don't you have any stuff?" Even though she just barged in without permission, I'm too sad to be upset about it. She doesn't have boundaries. Good to know. "I just moved in," I say, explaining my lack of stuff. The girl walks to my refrigerator and opens it. She sees the half-eaten package of Lunchables I left this morning and she grabs it. "Can I have this?" At least she waits for permission before she eats it. "Sure." She takes a bite out of a cracker. But then her eyes get wide and she tosses the Lunchables on the counter. "Oh, you have a kitten!" She walks over to the kitten and picks her up. "My mom won't let me have a kitten. Did you get it from Ruth?" Any other time I'd welcome her, really. But I just don't have the strength to be friendly during one of the worst moments of my life. I need to have a decent breakdown, and I can't do that with her here. "Can you please go?" I say it as nicely as possible, but asking someone to leave you alone can never not sting. "One time when I was like 5, I'm 17 now, but when I was 5, I had a kitten, but it got worms and died." "I'm sorry." She still hasn't closed the refrigerator. "What's her name?" "I haven't named her yet." Did she not hear me ask her to leave? "Why are you so poor?" "What makes you think I'm poor?"
"You don't have any food or a bed or stuff."
"I've been in prison." Maybe that'll scare her off.
"My dad is in prison. Do you know him?"
"No."
"But I haven't even told you his name."
"It was an all-female prison."
"Abel Darby. That's his name. Do you know him?"
"No."
"Why are you crying?"
I get off the mattress and walk to the refrigerator and shut it.
"Did someone hurt you? Why are you crying?"
I can't believe I'm going to answer her. I feel like this makes me even more pathetic, to just vent to a random teenager who walked into my apartment without permission. But it seems like it would feel good to say it out loud. "I have a daughter, and no one will let me see her."
"Did she get kidnapped?"
I want to say yes, because sometimes it feels that way. "No. My daughter lived with people while I was in prison. But now that I'm out, they don't want me to see her."
"But you want to?"
"Yes." She kisses the kitten on top of its head.
"Maybe you should be glad. I don't really like little kids. My brother puts peanut butter in my shoes sometimes. What's your name?
Kenna.
I'm Lady Diana.
Is that really your name?
No, it's Lucy, but I like Lady Diana better.
Do you work at the grocery store? I ask her, pointing at her shirt. She nods. I start work there on Monday.
I've worked there for almost 2 years. I'm saving to buy a computer, but I haven't saved anything yet. I'm gonna go eat dinner now.
She hands me the kitten and starts walking toward my door.
I have some sparklers. When it gets dark later, do you want to light them with me?
I lean against my counter and sigh. I don't want to say no, but I also have a feeling my breakdown is going to last at least until morning. Maybe another time. Lady Diana leaves my apartment. I lock the door this time, and then I immediately grab my notebook and write a letter to Scotty, because it's the only thing that can prevent me from crumbling. Dear Scotty, I wish I could tell you what our daughter looks like, but I still have no idea. Maybe it's my fault for not being honest with Ledger about who I was last night. He seemed to take that as some type of betrayal when he realized who I was today. I didn't even get to see your parents because he was so angry I was there. I just wanted to see our daughter, Scotty. I just wanted to look at her. I'm not here to take her from them. But I don't think Ledger or your parents have any idea what it's like to carry a human inside of you for months, only to have that tiny little human ripped away from you before you even get to meet them. Did you know that when an incarcerated woman gives birth, if they're almost finished with their sentence, they sometimes get to keep their babies with them? This mostly happens in jails, where the sentences are shorter. It sometimes happens in prisons, but it's rare. In my case, I was just beginning my sentence when I gave birth to Diem, which made it to where she wasn't allowed to stay with me in the prison. She was a preemie, and as soon as she was born, they noticed her breathing wasn't where they wanted it to be, so they immediately whisked her away and transferred her to the NICU. They gave me an aspirin, some oversized pads, and eventually took me back to the facility with empty arms and an empty womb. Depending on the circumstances, some mothers are allowed to pump, and their breast milk is stored and delivered to their baby. I wasn't one of the lucky ones. I wasn't allowed to pump, and I wasn't allowed anything that would help my milk dry up. 5 days after Diem was born, I was in the prison library, crying in a corner because my milk had come in, my clothes were soaking wet, and I was still emotionally devastated and physically spent. That's when I met Ivy. She had been there for a while, knew all the guards well, all the rules, how far she could bend them and who would let her. She saw me crying while holding a book about postpartum depression. Then she saw my soaking wet shirt. So she took me to a bathroom and helped me clean up. She meticulously folded up paper towels into squares and handed them to me one by one while I layered them inside my bra.
Boy or girl? She asked.
Girl.
What'd you name her?
Diem.
That's a good name. A strong name. She healthy?
She was a preemie, so they took her as soon as she was born. But a nurse said she was doing well. Ivy winced when I said that.
They gonna let you see her?
No, I don't think so. Ivy shook her head, and I didn't know it then. But Ivy had a way of communicating entire conversations through all the different ways she shook her head. I'd slowly learned them over the years. But that day, I didn't know the way she shook her head translated to those bastards. She helped me dry my shirt, and when we got back to the library, she sat me back down and said,
"Here's what you're gonna do. You're gonna read every book in this library. Pretty soon you'll start to live in the lavish worlds inside these books, rather than the bleak world inside this prison."
I was never a big reader. I didn't like her plan. I nodded, but she could tell I wasn't listening to her. She pulled a book off the shelf and handed it to me.
"They took your baby from you. You won't ever get over that. So you decide right now, right here. Are you gonna live in your sadness, or are you gonna die in it?"
That question punched me in my stomach. the stomach that no longer contained my daughter. Ivy wasn't giving me a pep talk. In a lot of ways, it was the opposite. She wasn't saying I would move past what I was feeling or that things would get easier. She was telling me that this was it. The misery I felt was my new normal. I could either learn to live with it or I could let it consume me. I swallowed and said, "I'm gonna live in it." Ivy smiled and squeezed my arm.
"There you go, Mama."
Ivy didn't know it, but she saved me that day with her brutal honesty. She was right. My normal would never be the same. It hadn't been the same since I lost you, and losing our daughter to your parents just pushed me even further from center. The way I felt when they took her from me back then is the exact same defeated misery I feel right now. Ledger has no idea how much his actions tonight have broken the last few pieces of me. Ivy has no idea how much her words from almost 5 years ago are still somehow saving me. Maybe that's what I'll name the kitten. Ivy. Love, Kenna.
Chapter 14. Ledger. I've received 3 calls from Patrick on my drive back to the house, but I haven't answered any of them, because I'm too angry at Kenna to have a conversation about her over the phone. I was hoping the Landrys didn't hear her beating on their door, but it's obvious they did. Patrick is waiting in my yard when I pull back into my driveway. He's talking before I even get out of the truck. "What does she want?" he asks. "Grace is a mess. Do you think she's going to try to fight the termination? The lawyer said it would be impossible." He's still spitting questions at me as he follows me into the kitchen. I toss my keys on the table. "I don't know, Patrick. Should we get a restraining order?" "I don't think you have grounds to do that. She hasn't threatened anyone." He paces the kitchen, and I watch as he seems to grow smaller and smaller. I pour him a glass of water and hand it to him. He downs the whole thing and then takes a seat on one of the bar stools. He drops his head into his hands. "The last thing Diem needs is for that woman to be in and out of her life. After what she did to Scotty. We can't. She won't show up here again," I say. "She's too afraid of having the cops called on her." My comment only heightens his worry. "Why? Is she trying to keep her record clean in case she can take us to court?" "She lives in a shithole. I doubt she has money to hire an attorney." He stands up. "She's living here?" I nod. "Paradise Apartments. I don't know how long she plans to stay." "Shit," he mutters. "This is going to destroy Grace. I don't know what to do." I don't have any advice for him. As involved as I am in her life, I'm not DM's father. I haven't been the one raising her since she was born. This isn't my fight, even though I've somehow immersed myself in the middle of it. I may not have legal say, but I have options. Strong ones. As much as the entire situation doesn't have one single positive outcome for all parties involved, the simple truth is that being a part of DM's life is a privilege, and Kenna lost that privilege the night she decided her freedom was worth more than Scotty's life. Grace isn't strong enough to face Kenna. Patrick may not be strong enough either, but Patrick has always made sure to at least pretend to be as strong as Grace needs him to be. He'd never act this distraught in front of Grace. He saves this side of himself for the moments Scotty's death gets to be too much, the moments he needs to escape and cry alone in my backyard. Sometimes I can see them both start to unravel. It always happens in February, the month of Scotty's birthday. But then DM's birthday comes around in May, and it breathes new life back into them. That's what Kenna needs to understand. Grace and Patrick are only alive because of Diem. She's the thread that keeps them from unraveling. There's no room for Kenna in this picture. Some things can be forgiven, but sometimes an action is so painful the memory of it can still crush a person 10 years down the road. Patrick and Grace get by because DM and I help them forget about what happened to Scotty long enough for them to get through each day. But if Kenna is around, his death will slap them in the face over and over and over again. Patrick's eyes are closed, and his hands are in a point against his chin. It looks like he's saying a silent prayer. I lean forward over the bar to try to keep my voice reassuring. Diem is safe for now. Kenna is too scared to have the cops called on her and too broke to start a custody battle. You've got the advantage. I'm sure after tonight she'll cut her losses and head back to Denver. Patrick stares at the floor for about 10 seconds. I can see the weight of everything he's been through settled squarely on his shoulders. I hope so, he says. He heads for the front door, and once he's gone, I close my eyes and exhale. Every reassuring thing I just said to him was a lie. Based on what I know of Kenna now, however little knowledge that may be, I get the feeling this is far from over. You seem distracted, Roman says. He takes a glass from me and starts pouring a beer a customer has had to order from me 3 times already. Maybe you should take a break. You're slowing us down. I'm fine. Roman knows I'm not fine. Every time I look at him, he's watching me, trying to figure out what's going on with me. I try to work for another hour, but it's Saturday night and it's loud. And even though we have a third bartender on Saturday nights, Roman is right. I'm slowing us down and making it worse, so I eventually go take the damn break. I sit on the steps in the alley, and I look up at the sky and wonder what the hell Scotty would do right now. He was always so level-headed. I don't think he got that from his parents, though. Maybe he did. I don't know. Maybe it's harder for them to think with a level head when they have such broken hearts. The door opens behind me. I look over my shoulder, and Roman is slipping outside. He sits next to me. He doesn't say anything. That's his way of opening the floor for me to speak. Kenna is back. DM's mother? I nod. Shit. I rub my eyes with my fingers, relieving some of the pressure from the headache that's been building all day. I almost had sex with her last night, in my truck, after the bar closed. He has no immediate reaction to that. I glance over at him, and he's just staring blankly at me. Then he brings a hand to his face and rubs it over his mouth. You what? Roman stands up and walks out into the alley. He's staring at his feet, processing what I've just said. He looks as shocked as I felt when I put 2 and 2 together outside my house. I thought you hated DM's mother. I didn't know she was DM's mother last night. How could you not know? She was your best friend's girlfriend, right? I never met her. I saw a picture of her once. And maybe her mugshot, I think. But she had long blonde hair back then. Looked completely different. Wow, Roman says. Did she know who you were? I still don't know the answer to that, so I just shrug. She didn't seem surprised to see me outside my house earlier. She just seemed upset. She showed up and tried to meet Diem today. And now... I shake my head. I fucked up, Roman. Patrick and Grace don't need this. Does she have any rights as a parent? Her rights were terminated because of the length of her prison sentence. We've just been hoping she wouldn't show up and want to be a part of her life. I mean, they feared it. We all did. I guess we just assumed we'd have some kind of warning. Roman clears his throat. I mean, to be fair, the woman gave birth to Diem. I think that was your warning. Roman likes to play devil's advocate in everything he does. It doesn't surprise me he's doing it now. What's the plan? Are they going to let Diem meet her mother now that they know she wants to be involved? It would be too hard on Patrick and Grace if Kenna were in their lives. Roman makes a face. How's Kenna gonna take that? I don't really care how Kenna feels. No grandparent should be forced to have to set up visitation with their son's murderer. Roman raises a brow. Murderer? That's a bit dramatic. Her actions led to Scotty's death, sure, but the girl isn't some cold-blooded murderer. He kicks a pebble across the pavement. I always thought they were a little too harsh on her. Roman didn't know me back when Scotty died. He only knows the story. But if he had been around 5 years ago to see how it affected everyone, and he still somehow managed to say what he just said, I'd have punched him for it. But he's just being Roman. Devil's advocate. Uninformed. What happened when she showed up? What did they say to her? She didn't make it that far. I intercepted her in the street and dropped her off at her apartment. Then I told her to go back to Denver. Roman shoves his hands in his pockets. I watch his face, looking for the judgment. How long ago was this? He asks. It's been a few hours. You aren't worried about her? Who? Diem? He shakes his head with a small laugh, like I'm not following. I'm talking about Kenna. Does she have family here? Friends? Or did you drop her off alone after telling her to fuck off? I stand up and brush the back of my jeans. I know what he's getting at, but it's not my problem. At least, that's what I keep telling myself. Maybe you should go check on her, he suggests. I'm not going to check on her. Roman looks disappointed. You're better than this. I can feel my pulse hammering in my throat. I don't know if I'm more pissed at him or at Kenna right now. Roman takes a step closer. She's responsible for the accidental death of someone she was in love with. As if that wasn't hard enough, she went to prison for it and was forced to give up her own child. She finally shows back up hoping to meet her, and you do God knows what with her in your truck, and then you prevent her from meeting her daughter, and then you tell her to fuck off. No wonder you've been slamming shit around all night. He walks back up the steps, but before he goes inside, he turns to me and says, You're the reason I'm not dead in a ditch somewhere, Ledger. You gave me a chance when everyone else gave up on me. You have no idea how much I look up to you for that. But it's really hard to look up to you right now. You're acting like an asshole. Roman walks back inside the bar. I stare at the door after it closes, and then I hit it. Fuck! I start pacing in the alley. The more I pace, the guiltier I feel. I've been unequivocally on Patrick and Grace's side since the day I found out what happened to Scotty. But the more seconds that pass between Roman's words and my next decision, the more uneasy I feel about it all. There are two possibilities running through my head right now. The first is that Kenna is exactly who I've always believed her to be, and she showed up here selfishly, only thinking of herself and not at all thinking of what her presence would do to Patrick and Grace, or even Diem. The second possibility is that Kenna is a devastated, grieving mother who simply aches for a child she desperately wants to do right by. And if that's the case, I don't know that I'm okay with how I left things tonight. What if Roman is right? What if I ripped away every ounce of hope she had left, If so, where does that leave her? Alone in an apartment with no future to look forward to? Should I be worried? Should I check on her? I pace the alley behind the bar for several more minutes, until I finally ask myself the question that keeps circling back around. What would Scotty do? Scotty always saw the best in people, even in those who I failed to find good in at all. If he were here, I can only imagine how he would be rationalizing all of this. You were too harsh, Ledger. Everyone deserves the benefit of the doubt, Ledger. You won't be able to live with yourself if she takes her own life, Ledger. Fuck, I mutter. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I don't know Kenna's personality at all. The reaction she had earlier could just be dramatics, for all I know. But she could also be in a really dark place, and I can't sleep with that on my conscience. I feel unsettled and frustrated as I get in my truck and head back to her place. Maybe I should feel a sense of relief that I now think Roman was wrong, but I just feel pissed. Kenna isn't holed up inside her apartment. She's outside, looking like she doesn't have a care in this world. She's playing with fucking fireworks. Sparklers. Her and some girl, twirling around in the grass like she's a kid and not a grown-ass adult who just hours earlier acted like her world was coming to an end. She didn't see me pull up because her back was to the parking lot, and she hasn't noticed I've been sitting here for several minutes. She lights another sparkler for the girl, who then proceeds to make a mad dash with her sparkler and leave trails of light with her as she disappears around the corner. Once Kenna is alone, she presses her palms to her eyes and tilts her face up to the sky. She stands like that for a few seconds. Then she wipes her eyes with her t-shirt. The girl reappears and Kenna smiles. Then the girl disappears, and Kenna lets her face fall back into a frown. She's just turning it on and off, and on and off. And I don't like that I like that she's pretending not to be sad every time that girl comes running back to her. Maybe Roman was right. The girl returns once more and hands her another sparkler. As she's lighting it, Kenna looks up and spots my truck. Her whole body seems to shrivel, but she forces a smile toward the girl and makes a motion for the girl to run around the building. As soon as the girl is gone again, Kenna begins to head in my direction. It's obvious I've been sitting here watching her. I don't even try to hide that. I unlock my door right before she reaches my truck and climbs inside. She slams the door. Are you here with good news? I shift in my seat. No. She opens the door and starts to get out. Wait, Kenna. She pauses, and then closes the door and remains in my truck. It's so quiet. She smells like gunpowder and matches, and there's a strange current inside this truck that's so palpable I expect the whole damn truck to explode. But it doesn't. Nothing happens. No one speaks. I finally clear my throat. Are you gonna be okay? My concern is buried beneath the stone-cold exterior, so I know my question seems forced, as if I don't care what the response might be. Kenna tries to get out of the truck again, but I grab her wrist. Her eyes meet mine. Are you gonna be okay? I repeat. She stares hard at me with her swollen red eyes. Are you? She shakes her head, seemingly confused. Are you here because you're afraid I might kill myself? I don't like how she seems to want to laugh at my concern. Am I worried you aren't in a good headspace? I ask, reframing her question. Yeah. I am. I wanted to make sure you were okay. Her head tilts slightly to the right as she turns her whole body so that she's facing me in her seat. Her shoulder-length strands of straight hair lean with her.
That's not it, she says. You're worried if I end my life, you'll be left feeling guilty that you've been so unbearably cruel to me. That's why you came back. You don't care if I actually kill myself. You just don't want to be the impetus for my decision.
She shakes her head with a shallow laugh.
You did it. You checked on me. Your conscience is clear now. Goodbye.
Kenna goes to open her door, and the girl she was lighting sparklers for suddenly appears at her passenger window. Her nose is pressed against the glass.
Roll down this window, Kenna says to me.
I turn my key so that I can roll down her window. The girl leans in, smiling at us.
Are you Kenna's dad?
Her question is so out of left field I can't help but laugh. Kenna laughs too. Diem has Scotty's laugh and smile. Kenna's laugh is her own. One I haven't heard before this second. One I want to hear again.
He's definitely not my dad, Kenna says.
She cuts her eyes to mine.
He's the guy I told you about earlier. The one keeping me from my little girl.
Kenna opens her door and hops out. She slams my truck door, and then the teenage girl leans in the passenger window and says,
Jerk.
Kenna grabs the girl's hand and pulls her away from the truck.
Come on, Lady Diana. He's not on our side.
Kenna walks away with the girl and doesn't look back. No matter how much I want her to, and don't want her to, and fuck, my brain is a pretzel. I'm not sure I could be on her side even if I wanted to be. This whole situation contains so many nooks and crannies and corners. I get the feeling choosing sides is going to be the downfall of all of us.
Chapter 15. Kenna. Here's the thing. It shouldn't matter if a mother isn't perfect. It shouldn't matter if she's made one big, horrible mistake in the past, or a lot of little ones. If she wants to see her child, she should be allowed to see her, even if it's just once. I know from experience that if you're going to grow up with an imperfect mother, it's better to grow up knowing your imperfect mother is fighting for you than to grow up knowing she doesn't give a shit about you. There were 2 years of my life, not consecutive, that were spent in foster care. My mother wasn't an addict or an alcoholic. She just wasn't a very good mother. Her neglect was validated when I was 7, and she left me alone for a week when some guy she met at the dealership where she worked offered to fly her to Hawaii. A neighbor noticed I was home alone, and even though my mother told me to lie if anyone asked, I was too scared to lie when the social worker showed up at our door. I was placed into a foster family for 9 months while my mother worked to get her rights back. There were a lot of kids and a lot of rules, and it felt more like a strict summer camp. So when my mother finally regained custody of me, I was relieved. The second time I was placed in foster care, I was 10. I was the only foster child, placed with a woman in her 60s named Mona, and I stayed with her for almost a year. Mona wasn't anything spectacular, but the simple fact that she watched movies with me every now and then, cooked dinner every night, and did laundry was more than my own mother ever did. Mona was average. She was quiet, she wasn't very funny, and she wasn't even all that fun. But she was present. She made me feel taken care of. I realized during that year that I was with Mona that I didn't need my mother to be spectacular or even great. I just wanted my mother to be adequate enough to not have the state intervene in her parenting. That isn't too much for a child to ask of the parent who gave them life. Just be adequate. Keep me alive. Don't leave me alone. When my mother regained custody of me for the second time, and I had to leave Mona, it was different than the first time I was returned to her. I wasn't excited to see her. I had turned 11 while living with Mona, and I came home with all the appropriate emotions an 11-year-old would develop with a mother like mine. I knew that I was going back to an environment where I would have to fend for myself, and I wasn't happy. I was being returned to a mother who wasn't even adequate. Our relationship never got back on track after that. My mother and I couldn't have a conversation without it turning into a fight. After a few years of this, when I was around 14, she eventually stopped trying to parent me, and instead, it felt like I had become her enemy. But I was self-sufficient by then, and didn't need my mother coming in twice a week and pretending she had any say over me when she knew nothing about my life or who I was as a person. We lived together until I graduated high school, but we were not friends, and there was no relationship between us whatsoever. When she spoke to me, her words were insults. Because of that, I eventually just stopped speaking to her. I prefer the neglect over the verbal abuse. By the time I met Scotty, it had been 2 years since I'd heard her voice. I thought I'd never speak to her again. Not because we had some huge falling out, but because our relationship was a burden. And I think we both felt like we'd been set free when that relationship broke down. I didn't realize how desperate I would one day become, though. We had gone almost 3 years without speaking when I reached out to her from prison. I was desperate. I was 7 months pregnant. Grace and Patrick had already filed for custody, and because of the length of my sentence, I found out they were also petitioning for termination of my parental rights. I understood why they were doing it. The baby would need somewhere to go. And I preferred the Landrys over anyone else I knew, especially my mother. But to find out they wanted to terminate my rights permanently was terrifying. That meant I wouldn't see my daughter at all. I wouldn't have say over her, even after my release. But because I had such a long sentence and there was no one else I could grant custody of my daughter to, I had to reach out to the only family member who could possibly help me. I thought maybe if my mother fought for visitation rights as a grandparent, I could at least be left with some control over what happened to my daughter in the future. And maybe if my mother had visitation rights with my daughter, she could bring my baby to the prison after she was born so I would at least be able to know her. When my mother walked into the visitation room that day, she had a smug smile on her face. It wasn't a smile that said, "I've missed you, Kenna." It was a smile that said, "This doesn't surprise me." She looked pretty, though. She was wearing a dress, and her hair had gotten so long since I'd last seen her. It was odd seeing her for the first time as her equal, rather than as a teenager. We didn't hug. There was still so much tension and animosity between us, we didn't know how to interact. She sat down and motioned toward my stomach. "This your first?" I nodded. She didn't seem excited to be a grandmother. "I Googled you," she said. That was her way of saying, "I read what you did." I dug my thumbnail into my palm to stop myself from saying something I'd regret. But every word I wanted to say was a word I'd regret. So we sat there in silence for the longest time while I tried to figure out where to start. She tapped her fingers on the table, growing impatient with my silence. "So, why am I here, Kenna?" She pointed at my stomach. "You need me to raise your child?" I shook my head. I didn't want her to raise my child. I wanted the parents who raised a man like Scotty to raise my child. But I also wanted to see my child. So as much as I wanted to get up and walk away from her in that moment, I didn't. "No, the paternal grandparents are getting custody of her. But," my mouth was dry. I could feel my lips sticking together when I said, "I was hoping you'd petition for visitation rights as the grandmother." My mother tilted her head.
"Why?"
The baby moved at that moment. Almost as if she was begging me not to ask this woman to have anything to do with her. I felt guilty, but I was out of options. I swallowed and put my hands on my stomach. "They want to terminate my rights. If they do that, I'll never get to see her.
But if you have rights as a grandmother, you could bring her here to see me every now and then. I sounded like the 6-year-old version of myself. Scared of her, but still in need of her.
It's a 5-hour drive,
my mother said. I didn't know where she was going with that comment.
I have a life, Kenna. I don't have time to take your baby on 5-hour road trips to see her mother in prison every week.
It wouldn't have to be weekly, just whenever you can. My mother shifted in her seat. She looked angry with me, or annoyed. I knew she'd be bothered by the drive, but I thought once she saw me, she'd at least think the drive was worth it. I was at least hoping she'd show up wanting to redeem herself. I thought maybe after finding out she was going to be a grandmother, she'd feel like she got a do-over, and she'd actually try this time.
I haven't received one phone call from you in 3 years, Kenna. Now you're asking for favors?
I didn't get a single phone call from her either, but I didn't bring that up. I knew it would only make her angry. Instead, I said, please, they're going to take my baby. There was nothing in my mother's eyes. No sympathy, no empathy. I realized in that moment that she was glad she'd gotten rid of me and had no intention of being a grandmother. I'd expected it. I was just hoping she'd grown a conscience in the years since I'd last seen her.
Now you'll know how I felt every time the state took you from me. I went through so much to get you back both times, and you never appreciated it. You never even said thank you.
She really wanted a thank you? She wanted me to thank her for being so shitty at being a parent that the state took me from her twice? I stood up and left the room in that moment. She was saying something to me as I left, but I couldn't hear her because I was so angry at myself for being desperate enough to call her. She hadn't changed. She was the same self-centered, narcissistic woman I had grown up with. I was on my own. Completely. Even the baby still growing in my stomach didn't belong to me.
Chapter 16. Ledger. Patrick and I started building the swing set in my backyard today. DM's birthday isn't for a few more weeks, but we figured if we could get it put together before her party, she and her friends would have something to play on. The plan sounded feasible, but neither of us knew building a swing set would be a lot like building an entire damn house. There are pieces everywhere, and without instructions, it's caused Patrick to mutter fuck at least 3 times. He rarely ever uses that word. We've avoided talk of Kenna up to this point. He hasn't brought it up, so I haven't brought it up. But I know it's all he and Grace have been thinking about since she showed up on our street yesterday. But I can tell the silence on that subject is about to end, because he stops working and says, "Welp." That's always the word Patrick uses before he's about to start a conversation he doesn't want to have, or if he's about to say something he knows he shouldn't say. I picked up on it when I was just a teenager. He'd walk into Scotty's room to tell me it was time for me to go home, but he'd never actually say what he intended to say. He'd just talk around it. He'd tap the door and say, "Welp, guess you two have school tomorrow." Patrick sits in one of my patio chairs and rests his tools on the table. "It's been quiet today." I've learned to decipher the things he doesn't say. I know he's referring to the fact that Kenna hasn't shown back up. "How's Grace?" "On edge," he says. "We spoke to our lawyer last night. He assured us there's nothing she can legally do at this point. But I think Grace is more concerned she'll do something stupid, like swipe DM from the t-ball field when none of us are looking. Kenna wouldn't do that." Patrick laughs half-heartedly. "None of us know her, Ledger. We don't know what she's capable of." I know her better than he thinks I do, but I'll never admit that. But Patrick may also be right. I know what it's like to kiss her, but I have no idea who she is as a human. She seems to have good intentions, but I'm sure Scotty thought the same thing about her before she walked away from him when he needed her the most. I'm getting loyalty whiplash. One minute I feel horrible for Patrick and Grace, the next I feel horrible for Kenna. There has to be a way everyone can compromise without DM being the one to suffer. I take a drink of water to pad the silence, and then I clear my throat. Are you at all curious about what she wants? What if she's not trying to take Diem? What if she just wants to meet her? Not my concern, Patrick says abruptly. What is? Our suffering is my concern. There's no way Kenna Rowan can fit into our lives, or Diem's life, without it affecting our sanity. He's focusing on the ground now, as if he's working all this out in his head as it's coming out of his mouth. It's not that we think she'd be a bad mother. I certainly don't think she'd be good. But what would this do to Grace if she were to have to share that little girl with that woman? If she had to look her in the eye every week? Or worse, what if Kenna somehow made a judge feel sorry for her and her rights were reinstated? Where would that leave Grace and me? We already lost Scotty. We can't lose Scotty's daughter, too. It's not worth the risk. I get what Patrick is saying. Completely. But I also know that after getting to know Kenna just over the last couple of days, the hatred I had for her is starting to turn into something else. Maybe that hatred is turning into empathy. I feel like that could possibly happen to Patrick and Grace if they gave her a chance. Before I can even think of something to say, Patrick reads the expression on my face. She killed our son, Ledger. Don't make us feel guilty for not being able to forgive that. I wince at Patrick's response. I've somehow hit a nerve with my silence, but I'm not here to make him feel guilty for the decisions they've made. I would never do that. I want her out of our lives and out of this town, Patrick says. We won't feel safe until both of those things happen. Patrick's whole mood has changed. I feel guilty for even suggesting they entertain Kenna's reasoning. She got herself here, and instead of expecting everyone in Scotty's life to conform to her situation, the easier and less damaging thing would be for her to accept the consequences of her actions and respect the decision Scotty's parents have made. I wonder what Scotty would have wanted if he could have seen this outcome. We all know the wreck, while preventable, was also an accident. But was he mad at her for leaving him? Did he die hating her? Or would he be ashamed of his parents and me for keeping Kenna from Diem? I'll never have that answer, and neither will anyone else. It's why I always find something else to focus on when I start wondering if we're all going against what Scotty would have wanted.